All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. Today, this is a little something special. We're not only doing this with our voices like a usual podcast does. We don't only have cameras pointing at us, but we're actually doing this all live so that our audience and our viewers can actually join in and kind of participate as being part of the podcast. So, and with me today is Jim Preston from Fove Inc., who are one of the OG companies, I'd say, in the VR space. They have a headset here that's sitting here. Hello, everybody. Thanks for everybody watching. Sending so much love. Thank you, Micah. So this is a headset that has eye tracking in it. Yep. It's white. It kind of looks really cool compared to every other headset. It's kind of black. So, so hello, welcome.
How are you doing? Thanks for the intro. We are one of the older in this somewhat new sort of recent phase of VR. Yeah, we've been around for a couple of years.
And that's right.
So we got started back in 2014, and it was just a couple of folks. Our founder in Japan, our CTO, who's Australian, and they both were sort of driven by this passion, and they wanted to bring eye tracking to VR. And that was back in the days when, you know, a couple of kids could say, "I'm going to make a headset."
I think that's how Palmer started himself too, right? It was just like, "I think I'm going to make a headset."
Yeah. This was before $2 billion acquisitions. This
right.
was back when, you know, folks who just put out a Kickstarter and have a $500,000 Kickstarter and be like, "Oh my God, we've got to make a company."
Right. And I think there was a lot of excitement from the Kickstarter. On our computer is actually our counterparts, our German counterparts, Chris and Peter. Hello, guys. They're watching in. Alexa, go away. they're actually original backers of. Okay, we don't need you, computer. Oh no, that was her trigger word. So there's been a lot of excitement about Fove for a long time, and it was originally essentially backed by Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's how it all started. So. I think originally the concept looked much bigger than this, and this is, I think, the 2.0, or what do you guys call this new headset?
We call it the Fove Zero because it's a dev kit. We want to be very clear and honest with folks.
Okay, so we went down in the numbering from 1.0 to, just joking.
we had engineering specs. It's actually the fourth iteration of the hardware. So we had an ES1, just in the same way that, you know, Oculus went through a DK1, a DK2, you know, before the CV1. Kind of the same thing with us. We went through... three different engineering specs, and this is the one that we settled on. And like every other headset, it's a series of trade-offs, right? I mean, there's a lot more we'd love to have done with the Fove, but at some point, you've got to put it out and learn.
That's right.
And so that's why we call it the Fove Zero, and we wanted to be very clear that, you know, our audience is the hardcore VR enthusiast. It's medical folks who want, you know, affordable eye tracking. It's, you know, artists and, you know, VR game makers who know that eye tracking is coming, and they want to get ahead of that curve. It's really not for consumers. And so that's why we want to be really clear. And that's why we call it sort of the Fove Zero.
So I want to put it out for our live audience. You guys can totally ask questions down below. We will have probably like every 15 minutes or so, we'll kind of go into looking at the questions and answering a few of them. So,
okay. Yeah,
I mean, I don't think too many people have had the opportunity to interact with Fove themselves because, I mean... I don't know. I haven't seen you guys at too many at the trade shows as well.
Yeah, we've been kind of quiet for a couple of reasons. One is we've been focused on actually shipping it, which is the toughest part. So we shipped in January.
Guys.
So it's
Kickstarter backers are getting it?
The Kickstarter backers should have theirs by now.
Awesome. Okay.
And so they're obviously the first in line. There might be a few folks that are still sort of at the tail end of that, but I'm pretty confident that all the Kickstarter backers have their Foves now, and including folks who pre-ordered as well. So we started taking pre-orders in November. So since January, it's been about learning, right? Because once you get it out to the public, that's when, you know, you start to realize like, oh my gosh, there's so many different PC setups and, you know, people have, you know, a Rift and a Vive running on the same box and they've got like dual cards SLI'd and they're like, why doesn't your stuff work?
And that's or even USB. And that's what I think Oculus is now dealing with is just different USB boards and problems that are.
You've got to just get out and learn. And so we haven't been on sort of the circuit doing the demos and stuff like that. We were at CES and we had some new announcements there, and we are at GDC and we had an AMD announcement we're really proud of. But for us, it was just shipping. This was such a big moment for us. So we have been a little bit quiet. But we will definitely be making more noise soon and having more to talk about.
That's right. Awesome. Well, I want to go to our audience here and see what our live audience is now talking
okay,
about.
Okay, great.
People, well, they're asking if there is on sale already, which I guess you just answered. We are live on Facebook. We are also live on Twitch. We haven't done most of the other things, but yeah, this is a fun, I think, experiment where I don't think too many podcasts do themselves live.
No, so, not much right now.
So yeah, guys, there, Abhijit Naik says, I'm a VR developer and entrepreneur, and we're using VR to build business. And he is a, looks like he was a backer as well. So he probably has his, headset by now.
If he was a Kickstarter backer, he should. If he doesn't, give us a shout on the Fove Facebook page.
Awesome.
And we'll get that looked at.
So, eye tracking.
Yeah.
I've tried a few eye tracking, I think, solutions now. Primarily back in like research days, those SMI, mm-hmm. We've used them in the past, and now they're actually getting integrated into headsets as well.
Right.
I tried that out at GDC. I think I also tried the Tobii headset eye tracker. You guys are coming from also a research background, correct?
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about, I mean, what is eye tracking? Why would you even want to have that in a headset? And because I'm sure there's a lot of people viewing this that it's probably their first time with research VR. So we'd like to go deep into the science behind virtual reality and talk about how it all works and why it all matters.
Sure.
Yeah.
So let me start with that last question of why it all matters. And, you know, eye tracking is really the most natural way you can possibly interact with a machine. And once you've tried it, you know, I became a believer when I tried the Fove was there was a speed and accuracy demo that we have where it's basically just as quickly as you can look around, you can sort of shoot these ships just with your eyes, and it's sub 30 milliseconds. And you're just sort of astonished because you've never had this experience before of being so closely intertwined with the machine, right? And you start to realize, my God, the machine is looking back at me.
Sure.
And it becomes subconscious, right? And that's when you realize that it is a much more natural interaction than even touching, right? So, you know, I think smartphones started to take off when, you know, we got sort of the touch, you know, touch screen sort of came along, and it's just, you know, you just look and touch, right? I feel that eye tracking is kind of the touch mechanic for VR, right?
It's reducing the level of or abstraction of intent, right, in terms of transferring intent into actual action in a software. So with mouse and keyboard, I guess you have to really think through in terms of moving your hand on a on a Z kind of Z axis into a mouse moving into the touch phone itself was like, I look at it, I can touch it. And now with eyes, it's like, I look at it, I select it.
Right. You know, and so that actually is going to be a real challenge. And this is something that we've talked about internally at Fove, and I think a lot of eye tracking experts will talk about, is we don't believe that eye tracking alone is going to replace sort of user interfaces. It's actually the two together.
Supplemental, right?
Exactly right. So, you know, just as you're not that fast with a controller or even a keyboard, obviously you're incredibly fast when you're typing, but navigating a user interface with a keyboard is fairly clumsy.
Absolutely.
Same things with a controller. But when you can simply look at what you want to select and then press a button and select it and even back out, even though if you know you've made a mistake, you can back out instantaneously before the interface even updates, right? We think it's those two things together. It's not eye tracking alone, because there's a huge challenge around determining intent. So, you know, we can track the eyes, we can know where the pupils are, we can know where the focal plane is, we can know what they're looking at, but you're doing a lot of different things with your eyes than selecting, right?
Because I think people have tried to do that, even with traditional 2D interfaces with desktops. They're like, oh, you can squint and you can, you know, select things. Those are unnatural motions. And I think if you try to just rely on eye tracking itself to do user interface and user interaction, then it starts to become a bigger hurdle than you need to overcome in terms of your hands and the dexterity.
It becomes self-defeating. If it asks you to do something unnatural about an interaction, it's the strength of it is the natural input, right? So if you tie it to blinks, suddenly you could accidentally select something just through your natural blinking cadence, right?
Right.
And so there are companies out there that want to sort of solve this problem where you can do basic like selecting and resizing, and you can do like gaze motions and things like that. There will be some of that. But I really do think that the future of VR and eye tracking, both, you know, with AR and MR, will probably involve some sort of either a gesture-based system or some sort of physical device, because you're just so much quicker than either alone.
True. So that's right. Keyboard, it was just UI was just with keyboards. And then when they added a mouse, suddenly that powerful combination hasn't gone away in like 30 years, right?
Right.
So that says something about some supplemental interaction compilations, let's say. Sure. With eye tracking, I mean, I think the most compelling experience about it was that it made me feel like I had the Force, like from the Star Wars. Right. So this is at GDC. I tried the SMI demo, which is SMI is another research company mm-hmm. in terms of just they do a lot of eye tracking software, and primarily before all of this technology was used by marketers to do kind of market research, to do like even grocery store research in terms right. of what do you look on the shelves. But now when you integrate it into a headset that people are using not only for games, not only for enterprise, you could the part that really impressed me was that I could look at an object, you know, 10 feet away and see it get highlighted by the fact that I'm looking at it, and then pick it up with my, you know, touch controllers and my Vive controllers and then move it. And I was like, whoa,
right.
That yeah. is cool. Like, I mean, that goes beyond market research into just games and interaction and even, you know, non-gaming things. You could now have a much farther reach than you'd be able to before. So
absolutely. And I think that one of the early benefits of eye tracking for people that are wondering about, like, look, how is it going to make VR better in a couple of years when all the headsets have eye tracking? And we can get to foveated rendering and the technical benefits sure. later. But for the user interface side, think about how difficult it can be to interact with 3D objects in VR right now. Right, as good as the touch and the wand vibes are, and as good as the Vive wands, excuse me, as you know, Leap Motion with the hand tracking sub 2 millimeter, they do a great job there. You know, imagine, you know, an RPG where you've got a storefront full of, you know, swords and daggers and potions and stuff like that. Right now, it's still yeah. a little bit clumsy, right? Picking out exactly what you want, even in Job Simulator, it can sometimes be, you know, picking up the right thing. With eye tracking, you just look at it, right? And and I think we're seeing the interfaces that are now with like Robo Recall, where you just sort of like get within a proximity of something, you snap it into your hand.
That's
which
right.
is, none of us really want to bend over and pick up anything, right? And so I think the immediate benefit for the UI and UX is, you know, locomotion, being able to just look at a place and being able to go right to it. Maybe we won't have to do the throw arcs. I'm not really sure, but certainly with objects in the world, you just look at it and sort of snap it in your hand. Really, what you want.
So that part is what I think excites me the most, because I'm super into UI and interactions,
right?
And VR is a huge shift from a lot of other things that we've done. Eye tracking also brings a few other benefits. Mm-hmm. We've covered a little of this before in other research VR podcasts, but I think it's great to hear it from, you know, from a company that's actually doing it. Another is foveated rendering, correct? Right. Do you yep. want to introduce a little bit of what that means for people that don't know?
Sure. So for folks who are new to VR or this kind of technology, it's a technique. So that's the first thing to put out there. It's a rendering technique. It's not unique to any one particular company. It's basically a way to draw the scene that just renders fully exactly what the user is looking at. So because we do pupil tracking in our case, we know where you're looking. The foveated rendering draws fully that area that you're focused on, and then there's sort of a gradient fall off so that objects further away at the periphery of your vision are lower resolution
right.
or fewer pixels, basically, than the objects at the center of your vision. And I want to be very clear about foveated rendering really quick. One, you know, the fove enables it. It doesn't provide it. So there's a lot of other links in the rendering chain. So the things like GPU manufacturers, as we all know, they have to sort of do some chip work to make the pages more accessible and we can get to them quicker for VR.
But they are, right? I mean,
they're working on it now. Yeah, I mean, right. NVIDIA AMD and Intel, Qualcomm, they're all working on their GPUs right now.
Because it makes the accessibility of VR for lower end things so much better, I think, right? Where we're right now, we're power hungry for GPUs to
right.
run VR, and we want it all to run off of our phones that have pretty good GPUs at this point.
Like yep.
they can stand up to, let's say, laptops from 5 years ago.
Right.
But to reduce that accessibility limit, I think foveated rendering has a big part in it.
Right.
So, and I'll mention this again for new viewers. I mean, the interesting part about foveated rendering is that your eye, it's literally mimicking the way your eyes work, which
exactly.
a lot of what VR is understanding how it works and then trying to mimic it so your brain doesn't distinguish it from reality.
Right.
If you notice at the edge of your vision, if you put your hands out, your hands are a lot more blurry and there's a lot more colors that you see, but that's not how you feel when you're walking around the space. Your
right.
brain is really good at filling in those details.
Right.
And so foveated renderer comes in
because of eye tracking, because of the ability to add both understanding where your eyes are looking at, understanding which part should be super high res and which part of your eye and your vision shouldn't be.
Right.
And so you have to do this at a very fast rate, right? And like if your eye trackers have to run at a, let's say at least 90 Hertz to match at least the display. But do you guys, what is the, I guess, the refresh rate of the eye trackers on the FOV?
So, I mean, there's two parts to that question. So the cameras themselves are at 120 Hertz, which we feel is fast enough to track the saccades, which are the movements of the eyes, the way your eyes sort of dart around. And then the refresh rate, so the refresh rate of the screen in the FOV, in the FOV is 70 Hertz. And the reason why it's that is because our screen is 2550 by 1440. So it's essentially a 2.5K screen.
Okay.
So we're limited literally by the screen driver. Right. I mean, that's what is the bottleneck for us. It's not that we don't want to do 90 frames, right? It's in this case, to do something so high resolution at the time, there had to be trade-offs. And so in this first version of the FOV Zero, we're limited at 70 Hertz.
Cool.
For the sake of a developmental experience, that's fine. You can still have a satisfying VR experience at 70 Hertz for most seated and standing sort of experiences. You know, you're exactly right in your description of foveated rendering. It blurs out sort of, depending on how you handle it or how you implement it, to the periphery of your vision. A couple things I want to make clear is it doesn't limit geometry. So what foveated rendering does, it doesn't actually, you know, cull any triangles, and it doesn't doesn't change the geometry of the scene, although it can do some basic LODing if someone wanted to do that, but it's not meant to limit triangles. So if you're in a scene where something incredibly complicated is happening, foveated rendering is not going to help you. If you suddenly or you have a lot of particles in the air, or you're doing an explosion, you have smoke or something like that that might have a lot of particles, or you have a wave that's very tessellated, that sort of thing. So it really is about pixels. It's about lowering the number of pixels.
Right. It's just not rendering, or not pushing as many pixels to the periphery.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's calling fewer pixels, right?
So, got it.
And you know, here at GDC 2017, we partnered with AMD and a company called Frima Studio up in Montreal, who are great partners to us. And we put together a foveated rendering demo running on Unreal. And it was, it basically, you know, depending on what's going on in the scene, the frame rate or the GPU improvement was at least 30%, and in some cases up to 100%. So it was doubling the frame rate. So we put a bunch of stuff in that scene, put a bunch of reflections, we, you know, put smoke and particles and stuff like that. And we were able to get the frame rate down to like 35 with it on. So it's just rendering everything. Hmm. You turn on the foveated rendering and go up to 70 frames.
Interesting.
And we're just in the early stages as rendering engineers sort of figure this out. Those savings are going to get better and better. I mean, foveated rendering is going to be crucially important to get to what we all want, which is 90 frames per eye, 4K resolution, tetherless, all that sort of stuff.
And I think it's going to be something that we don't even talk about. Kind of like how there's so many things that happen on the back end of computers and phones that, you know, there were huge amazements when they were first thought of, and now it's like, obviously.
Yeah, and it's hard to demo, because when you put it on someone and you're,
it's not like, supposed to feel like anything else, right?
No, it's just supposed to be able to look around the scene and they're like, turn it on, what are you doing? I'm like, it's on, man. it's much more impressive for everyone else who is looking at the monitor that can see like the low resolution of the monitor, right? But for the person inside it, they're like 30 seconds in, and I'm done.
All right, so I'm going to turn to our questions from our viewers.
Sure.
Awesome. So I, this is actually a question I wanted to ask as well, because Mike Abrash brought it up when they were doing the OC3 talk. He was kind of, Mike Abrash is, he's not the CTO, he's the head of research at Oculus. And they've obviously, they look at other technologies that don't exist in headsets, and he was kind of talking about how obviously foveated rendering and eye tracking are going to be very important, but he was like, this is 5 years away because everyone has such different eyes and heads. So they haven't implemented that yet. That was his reasoning. So how do you, I guess, try to average out the amount of different head shapes, eye sizes? I think the person that asked this question, let me see what your name was. Cecile Eskenazi. She says, yeah, have you solved the issue with the headset not fitting small heads? So, yeah, how can you even try and average out and account for everyone?
Yeah, that's it's a great point. And you know, first of all, Michael Abrash is, you know, a legend. And we certainly watched his talk with great interest. And I think his larger point around, you know, we're 3 to 5 years away from really good eye tracking, I think is true, much in the same way that I think we're still a few years away from perfect, you know, NLP, natural language processing, right? occasionally Alexa gets things wrong. Okay, Google, Cortana, they still sort of get things wrong. So to get it working 100% correctly, 100% of the time is always, you know, a big challenge. Sure. So, you know, the FOV Zero, we, you know, we don't want to claim that we do eye tracking, you know, 100% correctly, 100% of the time. That's simply not true.
Right.
There are plenty of challenges around people who sometimes have misshapen pupils, right? They're not perfectly round. Or people have deeply inset eyes, or people have very heavily lidded eyes where literally the camera has trouble actually finding them.
I would say that's people that have... It might sound horrible for saying this, but like actually it's because I'm actually part of it. It's like more Neanderthal features. Seriously. And like it's funny because I actually do have, according to 23andMe, I have more Neanderthal blood than most people do.
Well, I remember we tried it with you like a couple of months ago.
I know.
And it didn't work. It didn't work as well with you.
Too much caveman in me.
And I remember being a little bit frustrated because I'm like, I can see his pupils just fine.
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean, it's obviously, there's certain ethnicities that have a more deeply set eye. And for us, the cameras are at the bottom because they can't be at the top for things like eyelashes and eyebrows can be a challenge.
Essentially, I do have long eyelashes as well, which could be blocking the view. So you have two eye trackers, right? One per eye.
That's right. We have two infrared cameras and we have a series of infrared emitters.
Got it.
So
okay.
Basically what's going on, and there are many different ways to do eye tracking and IR tracking. But we have six very low-powered infrared emitters per eye. They light up the eyes. The IR cameras see them, and they do. They track the pupils. So just so everyone's clear, it's not, you know, there's no sort of laser in the retina or any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's basically, you know, even less, you know, IR power than you're exposed to in standard sunlight, that sort of thing. So it's very safe. But yes, it's two IR cameras that are tracking the pupils.
Right.
So, well, hold on. I think we answered the question, which was
small
heads are certainly a challenge, and that actually can be fixed easily with things like straps or the foam. We have sort of a foam insert here, and we can, you know, we can change out different side of foam inserts that'll sort of be able to use it for children or things like people with smaller heads.
I actually want to I'll pick this up. I don't think too many people have seen the FOV headsets, so right. We have one in the office now. It's a nice plush white, I have to say. It's got foam on the inside.
Hopefully it feels fairly light. It feels, you know, on par with a Rift or Vibe. Even a little bit lighter.
It feels essentially the same, you know, weight. It has three cords, much like a Vibe, HDMI, USB, and USB.
Three and two.
Okay, yep. So one for power and one for data in terms of the USB.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
And in terms of IPD adjustment, that's probably one of the biggest issues that people have with VR. I mean, how could you kind of account for IPD where, I guess, is there a slider or anything?
No, there's no physical slider. It's all in the software because we have to figure out where your pupils are anyway. We would like to get to a physical IPD, and it's one of the trade-offs that we had to make. And so as we're talking trade-offs, another thing I'll mention is eyeglasses.
Hmm.
So we don't officially support eyeglasses with the FOV Zero. However, they actually work pretty fine with mine. I have, you know, rimless glasses. I have a low power prescription, so it works, but we don't want to tell people that. And then, because really there's about 30% of the eyeglasses out there, it literally won't work. Either they have thick frames and they'll literally block the cameras,
right?
Or they have a really strong prescription and the IR, the infrared light is distorted in some way. And so, you know, we had to ultimately just sort of ship a headset. And so we don't officially support glasses, but it does work for a lot of folks.
Dries don't says that put it on. So,
you might have to let me know if you need to loosen up on some of the Velcro straps.
Okay.
I don't know. It's literally out of the box.
Yeah. Out of the box. So. Let's see. Oh, it fits fine for me. That actually feels really good.
Okay.
It feels, my eyes feel pretty close to I should probably speak into the mic. My eyes feel pretty close to the lens, which actually will increase the, FOV.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've noticed with the Vive and the Rift is that if you distance yourself from the lens, then you're just kind of losing out on the peripheral. So that felt really cool. I haven't seen it. Well, I haven't tried it on
in
a couple months.
Yeah. So our FOV is we say 90 to 100 depending upon, or 100 to 110, you know, depending on where it is on your face, right? So obviously the sponge size and then where your eyes are relative. So we can't give a firm FOV for a reason you just pointed out. But,
got it.
You know, hopefully it feels comfortable. And also we wanted the cameras fairly close to your eyes so we could illuminate your eyes and see everything as clearly as possible.
Christoph Izdebski, what's up, Chris? He's asking if it would support wearing lenses. I'm guessing he means contact lenses.
Yeah, contact lenses, unless you've got some crazy Japanese teenage girl lenses with like stars or something going on for your pupils.
Does that not work?
Which I know you're a fan of.
I was going to say, I mean...
Yeah, when you're cosplaying a Sailor Moon, I personally prefer Ivy from Soul Calibur when I cosplay.
There you go. You guys are a Japanese company.
Yeah, we are.
I do have to say.
We're one of the few. We are a Japanese VR company. We're headquartered in Tokyo. But yes, any contact lenses, colored lenses will be fine. Unless, like I said, you have something really exotic. But we're not coming across that so far among our community.
Awesome. I think the view of what's going to be coming with a standard, I'd say, even with within VR, either this year or next year. And you guys were the first ones that really put it on the map. So props to you guys on that.
Thanks, man.
Let's get into the heavy questions, I'd say, about...
Let's do it.
Privacy, right? This is kind of a big question, and it's much larger than VR and eye tracking, and this goes into just internet technology in general and what can be learned about a person, how much of their life is online, which is everything at this point, and what can be done with that. So with eye tracking, it seems like there's might be a trade-off between utility, which is like I said, those superpowers and the GPU optimization and everything that you get for, you know, being for a computer being able to look to know what you are always looking at. So I guess what's the conversation like on the manufacturing side when it comes to these kind of questions?
Right. So let me just start by saying that all of the folks that I know in eye tracking, not just Fove, but Toby, SMI, iTribe, iFluence, you know, everyone that's in this field comes from usually from an academic or sort of research background. And they come to it with a real sensitivity around this issue. It's something that's constantly talked about internally at Fove. And I know that, you know, it's something that, you know, Toby and SMI have spoken to recently in the past, the Voices of VR podcast, for example, with Kent Bai.
That's right.
So, you know, this is an important issue that, that I think everyone working on eye tracking is sensitive to. So I'll start by saying that. The next up is that the kind of data that eye tracking can give you either directly, but also you can extrapolate from. So things like, you know, pupil dilation, you can use that to make some educated guesses about what someone is interested in. You know, pupil dilation can be misread as well, right? If you go under cognitive load, your pupils will dilate a little bit. But also if you look at someone you find very attractive, your pupils will dilate a little bit, right? And it could be, things around your eye shape, right? You can make extrapolations based upon, you know, just, you know, are you showing the whole whites of your eyes and you know, just around, not just the pupils, but if you were to model the entire
eye. And when you combine that with, knowing where the hands are, knowing where their head is, knowing where their physical location in VR is.
Right.
I think you can really extract a lot of information
about
their context.
Let's talk about what's coming down the road after eye tracking, which is face tracking, right? With a mouth facing camera, and there's companies out there that are already working on stuff like that. And there have been some folks on the research side, I know at MIT and others that have already extrapolated emotions based on, you know, sort of facial mapping, just even using a laptop that we have nowadays. So there are a lot of serious issues that we're going to have to grapple with as a community. And the way I talk about it, the way I try to, you know, explain this to people is I use the analogy of Twitter. So, you know, nobody knows where Twitter is. I don't mean the building. I mean, we know where the building is. It's two blocks.
Next door,
We eat lunch there. But I'm talking about where is that language take place, right? So we know that, you know, there are some places, you know, the things you say in the bedroom, you've never seen in a courtroom. There are things you would say in a locker room that you would never say in a classroom, right? So we know that language has sort of different meanings or not meanings necessarily, but sort of different levels of permissibility based upon where it is. Nobody knows where Twitter is, right? So some people in the early days of Twitter, they thought they were making a joke. They kind of thought they were in a locker room and they made some sort of distasteful jokes only to come to find out, no, actually, apparently they're in a courtroom, right? So they really kind of destroyed their careers. They said something sort of embarrassing and stuff. And it was not because they were necessarily a bad person, but as a community,
they didn't understand the context.
We hadn't decided. Yeah. We hadn't said, where is this taking place, right? You know, I used to work I did game development for 12 years, and we'd always talk about when we go out to lunch in the car, there's a cone of silence, right? You can say whatever you want within the car on the way to lunch, right? It's not going to get back to the coworkers or something like that, right? But there was this understanding of like different spaces have different meanings. And Twitter, And a lot of the other online social media just sort of like forced us to sort of grapple with these issues. And I think eye tracking and the data that it represents is going to force us to make some decisions around what kind of data is, how personal is that data? And it's really data we've never had to grapple with before. So medical data, for example, I think we're all on the same page, right? So sure. If you had some sort of malady or pre-existing condition that's very private, it's between you and your doctor. We didn't want insurance companies knowing about that and stuff like that. But now we're going to be able to get data in real time that, you know, what does it say about you? Because the eyes are both conscious and subconscious. There are things that you do with your eyes that you're not necessarily aware of.
Probably more subconscious than conscious.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'll give you an example. I was raised Catholic, and I a long time ago, I got my degree in philosophy. And, you know,
this is why I have you on the podcast.
This is why you have.
This is because we can nerd out over this.
I got my PhD in political philosophy. And one thing you hear within this sort of virtue ethic tradition is first thoughts don't count. In other words, you can have things like you can think something like kind of nasty, kind of mean, but then you can check yourself. Go, no, that's not right. Right. You have this, the moral psychology of it is that you have these series of sort of, you know, competing desires or competing interests. And the first one you have, you shouldn't be judged by. Right. And I think we've all had that experience of, you know, walking down the street and seeing a homeless person and immediately sort of being disgusted and go, oh, no, that's not the right attitude. So really checking yourself and being reflexive upon your own attitudes. And I think that eyes are going to make this like really clear as there are places your eyes dart to that you're not even aware of, right? And the way that we look at other people, and we know even from basic gender studies, is when you look at other folks, you immediately look at the face, but you also look at the body, right? And you look at the arms, and you kind of look at the torso, but your eyes sort of dart around. And this is true of infants.
Triangle.
Yeah, basically, it just maps out, like, boom, yeah. What am I looking at, right?
Basic primal instinct, I'd say, of first determining friend or foe, and then determining, like, is this right for a mate, I'd say.
Just determining the basic gender of what I'm talking to. And we find, you know, there've been studies that even with young kids just go through this.
I've been watching a lot of, Planet Earth 2 lately.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. You got to think about humans as you're watching that and you're like, wow.
Right. So I think that's just one example of the kind of challenges that are coming our way is number one, that, you know, it's part subconscious and part conscious. Number two is, you know, going back to this question of the kind of data is there is a current school of thought that talks about your vision is an expression of your thinking, right? So, you know, I think everyone who works in VR, you know what redirected walking is, right? Everyone's sort of familiar with this concept.
And I'll re-explain it for people, new viewers joining in. Basically, redirected walking is if you have a big enough space and you have a VR headset on, or even if you have your eyes closed, if you walk straight forward, you'll probably end up leaning a bit. And so you can take that concept into VR, and then if you shift where the door is that you're trying to walk to in VR by left a little bit, you'll just keep thinking that you're walking straight, but you're actually being curved around so that you can essentially utilize more of the room,
right?
Get a more distance, feel like you're walking more straighter than you would be able to with the just dimensions of the room.
Exactly. It's by disjointing the user from what's going on in the virtual space from the real space, you can get them thinking they're walking in a straight line.
Right.
And the Mythbusters have done an episode on this. And we, as human beings, we just can't walk in a straight line blindfolded. We can't do it. We need the external world to walk in a straight line. And so one of the concerns right now is that same thing true of thought? Do you really need an external world in order to think in a straight line, right? So most of us probably grew up with a conception of sort of our mental model is that there's like a person inside our head who looks out through our eyes and that sort of speaks about the world and has a sort of unmediated direct access to the world, right? Well, it turns out that's probably not the way we actually think. We actually think in an extended world, sort of in a way that, you know, just imagine like in the old Metal Gear Solid games, your vision is a cone, right? You're part of a larger world. You think in a language, you think in an environment, right? The other people sort of change the way in, you know, how you respond, and your thinking is itself extended. So now, just in the same way we know there's such a thing as redirected walking, could there be such a thing as redirected thinking, right? Based upon how we're able to direct your vision, how we're able to sort of control what you're looking at, what you're focusing on, what you're paying attention to.
Absolutely. And I think the answer to that would probably be yes, in terms of, I mean, that is the nature of even marketing in a sense where let's say you put up an ad with no person in it versus an ad with a face in it. You're much more likely to look at the face. Therefore, you are kind of changing the way they're thinking at that exact moment.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure you can get down to the, in terms of definition of what that means, but there are ways of doing that. And I think that's really interesting is, and it doesn't all have to be bad. I'm thinking, even if you're trying to walk someone through an app and you know, if you can understand that, mm-hmm. oh, they're not understanding this part of the app, or they're not looking at this very definite feature that they should be using, mm-hmm. Redirect them to actually understand how that works.
Right. And there's actually distraction therapies that are designed mm-hmm. to really sort of gauge where people are looking at. And for example, PTSD, there are some early, maybe not early, but it's been around for a couple of years and are not sort of, they're somewhat still controversial, is the ability to use the sort of distraction therapy around the peripheral vision, how to get people to focus back on certain things. Hmm. But I think the larger issue is, and you know, what I just spoke to around redirected thinking, that's down the road because it involves audio, it involves, you know, cognitive understanding as well. And I think we're just, you know, VR is helping us understand how we do spatial cognitive reasoning. But the larger point is that eye tracking is going to present entirely new challenges in ways we really haven't thought about before. And I personally feel that things that we've been using now, like EULAs, you know, end user license agreements, those sort of things are really not up to the task.
To account for these new technologies.
Yeah, huh? Matt, yeah, you know, just draw out the line of what VR is going to look like in 5 years when we'll definitely have eye tracking in all the headsets. It'll all be tetherless, right? We'll probably have face tracking in a lot of these. You know, these are challenges that I think everyone in the industry is thinking about. And I think ultimately it's going to be us as a community that really has to make the early decisions about this rather than wait for legislation to decide for us. I think those conversations are just starting.
Yeah. And we would like to have those conversations here. I mean, with the manufacturers themselves, with the community amongst itself. We'd love to hear a little bit of what you guys think about the privacy concerns of, you know, when it comes to eye tracking, when it comes to VR plus eye tracking.
If I could, just one other quick note. At the very beginning right now, I think everyone agrees that there's two kinds of data. There's one, there's anonymous data where we just simply don't know who you are, but we're just sort of, you know, based upon, like, for example, your mouse movement is tracked. I think, you know, in a lot of web pages, they know exactly where you're moving your mouse. Mm-hmm. And some of this data is just not tied to you as an individual. And then there is personalized data. That's very different. That's the one we're worried about. That's what we're talking about. And I think you'll see in the early days of eye tracking, you'll see a lot of opt-in agreements. And it's one thing to do just sort of local analysis of eye tracking. It's something else to sort of put it onto a server. And so I think you'll see in the early days, there are probably going to be a lot of opt-ins around using eye tracking for things like consumer insights and user analysis and stuff like that.
Kenneth Jaramillo says Facebook, actually, which I guess that refers to Facebook has a very bad connotation about knowing mm-hmm. everything about its users, which, I mean, it's kind of true. They mm-hmm. really do know a lot. And if Oculus has an eye tracker in there, what does that mean in terms of advertisers? I think what that could mean is that you'll probably get more relevant ads, which is what, like, the byproduct of Facebook. Mm. Facebook's overreaching arm has at least felt like in my life. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it affect me too much, but I think it's still a concern that most people at this point are having. And even, and I think I'll open it up from beyond American politics into, mm-hmm. and this is something that is even more than outside of VR, but, like, what if it's a government, like, let's say a tyrant government that mm-hmm. does have a very strong arm and they can collect this data about their population and then, you know, implement crazy policies around that, even if our laws here don't allow for that. So I think that's a very fine line to be walked. And I'm not saying that VR is suddenly going to blow up in these tyrant countries, but, you know, how do we even start approaching that those issues? And I mean, I don't know. I want you guys to suggest things. I'm very curious to hear. Let us know.
Yeah, I think for the issue in the privacy issue and the misuse by governments, I think eye tracking is actually not particularly unique in that we have been giving away a lot of our own personal data voluntarily for a long time in exchange for really conveniences, in some cases small conveniences, in some cases tremendous conveniences like Google Maps, which I use, you know, on a daily basis. And I think the same thing is going to be true of eye tracking. You're going to give away data about yourself because you're going to get, for example, you know, what we just heard from Alexa earlier in the podcast, and I have Alexa at home, and she's, I should say her name in pig Latin or something, Alexa Gay or Alexa Lay. And she's a fairly sort of dumb bot in the sense that she just simply responds when I ask specific sort of questions her. She doesn't in any way react to me, right? She doesn't know anything about the tone of my voice, which we love, my fiance and I love to, like, talk smack to her, but and she doesn't know anything about like where I'm looking or any of that stuff. She doesn't know. You can't extrapolate any sort of guesses. And I think that eye tracking that's going to be coming, because there's, you know, how many things look at you right now, right? And I know in my home, I have three things that are looking at me. I have my Xbox One, I have my webcam, and I think my PS VR, you know, so I have things already looking at me. And I think there's four things listening to me just in my home right now in 2017. You know, just stretch that out to the future. You're going to have multiple things listening and looking at you. So there are going to be all sorts of conveniences and trade-offs. Now, right. The question is, do we really want, has everyone had a chance to think about and sort of opt into those trade-offs?
I'd say, and I'll say this, where I don't think it'll be more distinct different platforms that are going to be looking at you and more like centralized into one, let's say, home running AI.
Right.
That I'm mentioning this is because Danny Austin is saying, not sure what can be gained by eye tracking movement, where Emmanuel Pisa is saying that I'm not concerned about privacy as long as the info is used in my benefit, which totally different opposite opinions. And I think I understand both. But what I'm thinking is that if you want to turn on, if you're sitting down on your couch at home and you want your lights to turn off. Before Alexa, before all that, you could, you know, have maybe a sibling or a spouse or someone that's around you that's standing up. They're like, hey, can you turn those off? And like, you can't, might not even look at them. You would just be looking at the lights and like pointing to them.
Right.
And then there's a lot of intent and extrapolation that happens there for that action to be completed. What if with eye tracking, whatever headset you're wearing, you like look at your lights and you're like, can you turn that off? And you're actually saying that to the AI, and it knows what you're looking at, it knows what you're trying to do,
right?
And it does its task a little bit better. I think that's one simple way.
I think that's absolutely coming when we talk about eye tracking in AR and MR as well. And VR is obviously an enclosed, and in some sense, it's an easier use case for eye tracking because the entire headset is enclosed. We really can control exactly, you know, how much light is in there getting in your eyes and knowing where you're looking, because it's often in a rendered or sometimes pre-rendered environment. AR is going to present a different level of challenges because you've got day and nighttime, you've got ambient IR, and you've got the world itself. But you're right. I think it's certainly coming. And you know, being able to look at a table or being able to ask, what is that? Just by looking at it, right? Not have to Google, not have to type in, you know, what kind of car is that? Just look at that car and ask, what is that? So I definitely think that's coming as well.
One big feature actually that rarely gets mentioned or hasn't even really been introduced by any of the major eye tracking people is the opposite side of security. Rather than, you know, being a privacy issue, it's actually you can gain a lot more security of your apps if you don't have to type a password in anymore, but you actually all you have to do is look at, you know, look inside your VR headset. And since our pupils or our irises actually have like very distinct fingerprints, they're built very differently. I mean, even each eye is different from the other.
That's right.
So that's a lot better form of identification than even your fingerprint.
That's right.
So that could totally be a thing if all these VR headsets have eye trackers where you don't really have to type a password anymore. Have you guys kind of experimented on that aspect of things? I know iFluence was kind of into it when they were first around. Now they're acquired by Google.
Sure. So the answer, around iris tracking, you can do user-specific actions. So things like login, authentication, purchasing, and passwords, that sort of stuff. Yes, absolutely you can do that. I can't really talk too much about what we're working on next. That would be a logical extension of what we've been doing. And I agree to your point about security. It's going to be, I think the default way to do security is going to be much safer than anything and much quicker and much more frictionless than anything we've had before. The day of, you know, remembering, you know, 36 long character passwords so that, you know, only you and Edward Snowden have access to your documents. I think those days will hopefully be gone in the next few years. But yes, I do believe that eye tracking can make us a lot safer. And we haven't even really talked about all the other benefits that eye tracking can bring on, you know, the medical side of things, where we're getting a lot of interest from the medical community here at FOV. And there's a lot of benefits that come from eye tracking. It isn't, you know, it's easy to sort of let your mind go towards the dystopian sort of abuses of eye tracking. And, you know, there's going to be consumer benefits and conveniences, but there's a lot of medical benefits as well.
You triggered other people's Alexas when you said Alexa.
Did I?
Sorry, Gunrun, if I
Alexa,
did it again.
Alexa, order more toothpaste.
No.
Sorry.
You shouldn't have.
I could have been something other than toothpaste. Sorry.
I want to read a couple of comments out here. Thomas Bedank. Hey, how you doing, Thomas? He says, I think eye tracking will, even more than foveated rendering, be most valuable for getting more information on the user's attention and using it directly to shape their experience. I totally agree about that. I think having dynamic apps and dynamic even games, dynamic Instagrams
dynamic
and Facebooks.
GUI. Imagine a GUI that basically you just modularly design, but if you find that people are looking for ammo on the lower right, but their eyes never go to the lower right after 1,000 uses, then the dynamic GUI should move the ammunition up towards, you know, the famous F pattern, which is where we usually start to scan.
Yeah.
Then a user interface should change to adapt to the way that people naturally look at a scene.
Absolutely.
So the saccade pattern, you know, the basically when your eyes search a scene, you're typically searching for something in particular, unless you just happen to be scanning it. And we can extrapolate just from your saccade patterns, you know, kind of what your intention was for that scene.
Yeah.
And so if there are things that we know we're asking you to do something, or it's, let's say, an RPG experience or narrative experience, you know, you could set up things. You could change the lighting a certain way so as to sort of direct the eyes around the scene. So it absolutely can be customized. And I would imagine, especially for horror games, that, you know, this is a big challenge for the whole genre right now in VR is being able to adapt to the particular users. Some people are very sensitive and they have really quite traumatic experiences in some of these early horror games. Others are much more sort of desensitized to it or and actually enjoy it. But I think in that sort of experience, you can, you know, bring the music down, bring the lights up, slow things down or something like that.
If you're or make to, it more intense, right?
Or maybe if the person is bored, if their eyes are just sort of looking around or they're just looking at things that you really didn't want them to look at, then you could dynamically, you know, turn on lights or cause a sound or something like that.
I would say it's literally equivalent to having like a person. Because persons are essentially analog eye trackers, right? Like I know where you're looking. I know what your intentions are. I know if you're into something or not. And if you personalize, let's say an app or an experience or even an AI, then they have those same capabilities of understanding your context and your intent. And so I think the applications of eye tracking are like the cool things that it's going to be bringing up, I think we haven't even covered yet.
We don't even know. Like, I'm wondering what is going to happen to the eSport, you know, FPS community, right?
What about, so do you...
So, like, if you can, if you don't even have to go to the, you know, the really great players have to do first through the acquisition, identification, and then there's a whole, like, steps that used to a target. Sure. And within, like, you know, half a second, the really good players can get these, like, headshots off. But now that most players can basically do acquisition by simply looking, right? Like, what's that going to do Overwatch when everyone's playing McCree and just sort of, you know, it's not perfectly accurate. I don't want to exaggerate, but it is going to change, I think, the way, you know, a lot of genres are actually played. And I don't know what it's going to do to the competitive scene.
What do you, I mean, my first reaction is that, no, they wouldn't allow eye trackers in there. It's like, there is the whole point of the competitiveness is how fast your fingers can twitch around.
I can tell you there are teams right now that are training with them.
Oh, damn. Really?
Yeah.
Tell me more about
that. I don't know anything more about it.
Ah, Jim. Wait, that's really interesting.
Just for practice. Right? Oh,
I see what you mean.
Your ability to just, I don't mean cheating. I'm sorry, I didn't suggest that.
And not to actually change the dynamics of the sport itself. It's more about like actually seeing how fast your reaction times are, right?
Okay. Being able to sort of measure your ability and, you know, your ability to do sort of a twitch headshot and all this other stuff and how you like scan around environment looking for dangers and that sort of stuff. So I know eye tracking for some teams, they're already using it in kind of their practice mode. So, you know, really interested to see how it changes shooters, really interested to see how it changes RPGs. When you imagine characters will know if you're looking at their weapon, right? You know, I would love to see Mass Effect with eye tracking where you have all of these interactions where, you know, the Krogan knows that you're, you know, eyeing
knows
up what he's wearing.
And it knows if you're going to go with the aggressive option or the...
or the Ansari. The Ansari that knows you're checking her out. And that's her whole point, right? That's the whole point of the species is they kind of change themselves to be attractive to the different races. So yeah, we have no idea how eye tracking is going to affect all of these genres. I hope it'll make RTSs a little bit more quicker for me. My skills are rusting, but yeah, you're right. We don't have any idea what's going to happen.
It's been a fascinating conversation. I actually really want to go through and like read these after the fact as well. I don't know if we can post these in the show notes in terms of the comments and the people, but thank you everybody for watching for our first kind of live podcast for the Research VR
podcast.
This was great. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Oz, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Thanks to everyone for all these great questions. I thought it was really informative, really fun.
How can people find you?
Fove is, we're at www.getfove.com. We're taking orders right now. Obviously, we're on Twitter as well and Facebook, all the regular places.
This is what you would be getting.
Yes, the Fove Zero that we're shipping now.
Fove Zero. Does it come with controllers?
We do not have peripheral controllers. This is another thing of like, do we want to support this? And so you get, we do Rift style positional tracking. So it comes with a tracking camera and an extra sponge and that sort of thing. But it's $600. So roughly competitive, you know, kind of in that same window with the Rift or the Vive. And, you know, SDK, and we've got some prototypes and tools and stuff out there. So right now we just want to get out to people and have the developers start making really cool stuff.
And how can people reach you specifically if they want to talk more about philosophy and eye tracking?
The easiest way is to probably email me directly at jim.preston@fove-inc.com.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Jim, again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, man.
And we'll see you guys next time. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Bye.